The closing talk for about 40 minutes, aiming to finish at 9 a.m. And at 9 a.m. we can have toilet break, or rather letting go time. And then at 9:15, I invite everybody back to give the standard metta meditation and then the final blessing for this retreat. So during this retreat, I've taught many, many things. And like most of the retreats, I don't exaggerate on this. You never plan a retreat, what you're going to teach. It's very much tuning in to the people who are here and finding out roughly what the majority really want to listen to and how they want to be instructed, and with a little bit of humour, some deep stuff as well, but encouraging, inspiring, and also instructing as well. And hopefully that here you've found a lot of Dhamma insights which make you calm, and also gone deeper into the calm states of mind and enjoyed a great, great peace. And in fact, as a monk for many years, just all of the teachings, yes, they're important, but I value the peace even more than the teachings. For me, the Dhamma, the teachings, the insights, they're all a means to the end, which is to be so peaceful and so still. That is where all the joy and the meaning comes from. So I know when I've been asked what's the meaning of life, and to give many, many different answers. One of the answers which I give, which was important, I just reminded myself of it a few seconds ago, when somebody got their camera out and took a photo of me. I thought, what the heck are you doing that for? I'm not handsome, I'm not young. But for some reason, which is beyond me, when people want to take photos of me, that I will always smile at you. Because for me, that's the meaning of, one of the meanings of my life. To actually forget about what I want or what I need, but to actually to give other people happiness. So that's one of the things which you learn over here. It's not just about you. It's always about us. And to make people happy, even I think it's the stupidest thing in the world, but I will always do that. And I'll contribute and smile. So it's not about what I think is the right or what I think is wrong. You don't judge. Because sometimes if you're too intellectual, too much in your head, and you don't feel your heart, you actually really do disconnect with people. And you miss a lot of the importance of the Dhamma, of, you know, just simple kindness. And it's because understanding the meaning of life is actually not to be proud and demanding in nature, which is what I've been chanting every day. It is brainwashing to be not conceited, not to be to be easily satisfied. That means that you don't get so upset and angry at life. You don't demand so much. You're not such a control freak, wanting to have it this way and that way. You don't worry about, stop disturbing my meditation. No, you're very happy that somebody's actually in here and they're joining you in the cottage. Yeah, they do bang the doors, but that's the best they can do. At least they're here, and that gives me so much joy that a person's actually on the path to meditation. So instead of looking at all the things which are wrong, I always look at all the things which are right. It's a gratitude, and it's a kindness, and it's learning how to be with people. And it's also learning how to be with yourself, because as I mentioned, in much of the meditation, all the hindrances are trying to escape from something or other. And all we're really trying to escape from is because of fear, of actually just of letting go of this thing which we take ourselves to be, letting go of ourselves. I always notice that all fear is when you're about to lose something which you think is important to you. And that gives you fear, losing your health, losing your freedom, losing, you know, if you have a... Oh, I always remember this story, I haven't told it for a while. Of this gentleman, Patrick, his name was, 32 years ago, he was one of the first, if not the first, Anagarika, you know, the attendant at Bodhinyana Monastery, when we first went there. And he was what we call like a monastery hopper. So he would go from monastery to ashram, to any place which was remotely spiritual, spend a few months there, help out, and then get on his bike and go to another place throughout Australia. And his bike was an incredibly expensive Harley Davidson. It was the only possession he had which was of value. He didn't have a house or a home or bank accounts. He lived so simply. And you know, he would just get a job here, do small errands there, and maybe have a bit of a pension. And that was his life, going helping up Buddhist monasteries and temples. And he was, once after 3 or 4 months here, he got on his Harley and went over to Sydney or Melbourne, somewhere out east. And he wrote the amazing story that he went into some shopping centre, parked his bike, and went down to get his stuff. And when he came with his shopping bags, he found that someone had stolen his Harley. It was the only thing in the world which he owned, which was of any value whatsoever. His clothes were just rags. Well, not rags, but they're pretty daggy. And that's why he fat into Bodhinyana Monastery. And it was the only thing which was of any value, both monetary, but also it was a symbol of his freedom. That he could, whenever he felt like he wanted to leave a place, he'd just get on his bike and he'd just ride whichever direction he wanted to go in the huge island of Australia. And so when he saw it, someone had taken his bike, it was stolen. First of all, you know, there was a disappointment. Then the anger, you know, what lowlife had stolen this. But very quickly, he came to this wonderful sense of letting go. And he wrote this to me because all the teachings which he heard, all the brainwashing he had, actually worked. You know, someone had stolen his only possession, and he could let it go. And he said he was wishing the thief, whoever it was, had as much fun and joy with the bike as he had had. May he also enjoy it riding down the roads of Australia. It had given him so much pleasure for so many years. Now he hands it over to whoever stole it. He was so proud of just how much he could let go with no ill will, but actually giving metta to the thief who stole his only possession. And feeling so proud of himself and so pleased, it was only then that he realized he was in the wrong floor of the car park. They all look the same. When he went to the correct floor, there was his bike. But he said what a wonderful test that was. You know, he learned how to let go and what the real meaning of life was. Yeah, it's expensive and it was really valuable to him, not just monetary but otherwise, but he could let it go. And he said how powerful this path is. So it's little things like that, you know, get brainwashed into you. Whereas other people in this world get very, very upset when they've just lost their car keys. Oh, I lost my car keys. I can't find my car keys. But others of you, if you lose your car keys this afternoon, hey, I've got a good excuse to stay here for another couple of days. Because RAC, do they work on Saturdays and Sundays? You probably have to wait till Monday to get them to come here. I could arrange them to not to work on Saturdays and Sundays for you. So the point was that many, many things which cause us suffering in life, attachments, we learn to let go of. So we can find much more peace and happiness in life. It gives us a deeper meaning. And what you practice here is not just what you do for meditation. It actually goes out into your daily life. This story I said the other day of the monster who came into the Empress's palace. Really big and nasty. You may have such a monster, we call them yakas in Buddhism, in your office waiting for you on Monday morning when you go to work. Big and angry. What have you been doing? I need your help. But even those yakas in the office, your boss, how do you deal with them? And it's wonderful stories of people who've learnt their meditation here and who go to work and get complete control over their bosses. What a wonderful thing to learn. And this was one of the stories, one of my favourite stories. It was Julie, she lives in Sydney. I'm going to Sydney tomorrow. Hopefully I might see her over there, one of the talks. Years and years and years ago, she was just starting off her business, fashion business. And she got a call or an email, I forget which, from a big company in London. She'd been trying to get a contract to distribute her designs, and now they were interested. Can you come as soon as possible to actually sign a contract? And this was like big money. This was actually the break she was looking for. But of course, there's problems. She had a small daughter called Holly. And you know, she's, at that time, Holly was about 4 or 5 years of age, blonde hair, blue eyes, very pretty girl. And they had to abandon Holly for three or four days. She had a very, very supportive husband, David. But you know, it's really tough for a mum to leave her child, but had to. So she got on the first available flight to London, and it's tough because she only had time just to check into a cheap hotel, shower, change, and go to the boardroom to actually for the meeting with the CEO. And any one of you who's traveled that far knows just how tiring it is, especially don't have any chance for a rest, but straight to work. So she went into the boardroom, and it was very disappointing. The other board members were there, and they told her she'd wasted her time. They said, this is what she told me. They advised her, just go back and get the next flight to Sydney. There's no way our boss is going to sign any contract. He's in a bad mood. He's really upset and angry, shouting at everybody. But this little girl, Julie, you know, probably what everyone would do. I've come this far. I'm not going to leave now. At least I can see the guy and explain my case. And they said, well, suit yourself. So that she sat in a corner of the boardroom, meditating, waiting for the CEO to come. And her meditation was this beautiful metta meditation, loving kindness. And after about 10 or 15 minutes, the CEO came in to the boardroom and saw her. Who's that sitting there in my boardroom? What do you think she's doing? As I said, I enjoy this because you know, I'm not allowed to raise my voice except when I'm playing around and acting. What does she think she's doing here? And he's really angry. You know, big red eyes like you know, real yakkers. You know, steam coming out of his nostrils. And look really frightening. But this little girl, Julie, she's obviously woken up out of her meditation. She stood up and just walked towards him. And because her meditation was just so peaceful and so kind, she knows it was automatic. You can't plan things. And she looked him in the eye, and he was glaring at her, about to, you know, rip her apart. And she just said to him, "You have such beautiful blue eyes like my baby Holly back in Sydney." And that was the first time the CEO had heard when he was shouting at someone how beautiful his blue eyes were. It was totally unexpected. And his poor CEO didn't know what to do next. The word I use, he was discombobulated. And it's like all the fuses went off in his brain. He didn't know how to handle this one. And his face softened within a minute or two. And he smiled. He said, "Oh, really? I've got beautiful blue eyes." She said it was such metta, such kindness, it melted this guy. And she had her contract signed in the next 5 minutes. And she was so happy, come all that way, got her stuff signed. So she went to go back to her hotel to take a rest, you know, after a really long flight. But she couldn't get out of the boardroom, she told me. Because all, you know, the CEO had left after signing the contract, but all the other directors, they surrounded her, like in a circle. And they said, "We're not letting you go until you teach us how you did that." We've never seen anything like that before. And so she had to stay for half an hour now and teach them how to do meditation. There's a lovely true story about just how what you learn here is not just to get enlightened. It's not just to see nibbitas and have a time of your life. It actually works in your daily life. You actually take it out there into the world. And it changes so, so, so much. Recently, what's really interested me about this type of meditation which is a very soft and kind and gentle meditation, but takes you very deep, is also just how one of the great side effects is great health. And I've seen so many occasions of this. One which comes to mind on one of these retreats, which was, we were holding it in North Perth before, in the Redemptorist Monastery. They kept putting the prices up, which meant that we decided to build our own retreat centre to keep it, you know, inexpensive for those who can't afford it. It was a huge amount of money used to pay then, about $400, you know, sort of for the whole retreat. And, you know, it's much more austere than this place. You didn't have your own en suites. I remember those little rooms they had. When somebody turned the water on upstairs, it made the pipes rattle. So anyone who went to the toilet in the middle of the night, you'd wake up. So it was a very noisy place. But, you know, it's the only place we could have at the time. Remember, many of you went to the North Perth retreats. And I remember just this one fellow came to check in. And you know, I say many weird people come on these retreats, and a pleasant company accepted, of course. This guy appeared in a rubber face mask. Now this, you know, North Perth is just outside Northbridge, and it's a nightclub district of Perth, so many weird people are around there. And I thought, you know, what's a guy coming in a rubber face mask to a retreat for? And he explained that he had this really terrible eczema, this rash, psoriasis, I think he called it, all over his body. And he told me about it. He lifted up his trousers as far as they could go. And it's this really terrible rash all over him. And he opened up his shirt, and there was a rash there as well. And he said, it's on my face. It's every square inch of my body, everywhere. And the reason I got this face mask on is to stop me scratching, you know, my skin. To stop me scratching my skin. It's got a bit of a cold. To stop me scratching my skin. And he said, I don't know if I can last even like half an hour in your retreat, simply because it's so torturing. It's 24 hours, and nothing can stop it. We tried all the medicines, the steroids, everything, but nothing works. So there he was. He said, if I can't stay here for 5 minutes, it's not because of your talks or your bad jokes. It's just, which is there all the time. But he lasted the whole 9 days. I'm so proud of him. And the best part was, at the end of the retreat, he had his face mask off, and he had this huge smile on his face. And he said, look at my skin. And then, with great pride, as the only person who's ever done this to me at the end of the retreat, he opened up his shirt to show me his chest. No one has ever done that. And it was clear. And he lifted up his trousers, and there was a little band, maybe an inch, around each ankle. He said, that's all that's left, that's all that's left. And everything else is, for many people, they'd be really concerned about that. For me, that is nothing. Nothing compared to what I was experiencing when I first came in on this retreat. Thank you so much. Thank you. And that was a thank you which really I will never forget. Because I can't sort of know what he felt like, but just looking at that, that must have been like being tortured. No peace at all. 24/7. At least if you get tortured by these sadists in its underground dungeons sometimes in the world, sometimes they leave you alone to go to, they have a sleep, but this fellow was being tortured 24/7, and now he was free. And so that made this meditation, wow, so amazing, so great it works. And one of the other stories from over in Sydney is in Wat Buddha Dhamma. I gave a retreat there many years ago. And in the hall there, there's someone in the question time, they wrote all these notes, not just one, about five or six people. Can you please ask meditators not to breathe loudly in the hall? Because this guy was breathing so loud. And people was being so disturbed. And then I had to tell everybody, because he too had checked in, said that fellow has got this huge tumour in his nasal passages. No, he's been given only maybe a month, 2 months to live by his doctors. No further treatment possible. And he's only come here to try meditation. Who knows? It's what they call the last throw of the dice. Maybe it works or maybe it doesn't. And he's only breathing through his mouth like that because his big tumor up his nose is all blocked. And it's wonderful that as soon as you know why people make noise or why they do what they do, straight away compassion takes away all the irritation. And when they were sitting there, they told me that, yeah, he's making noise, but they felt so much love and care. Oh, please, you're trying. Breathe, whatever you can. It's not disturbing me. Because the irritation was replaced by just kindness and support for this guy. And of course, it always has a good ending. That the last time of the retreat, I don't know why this always happens to the last time of the retreat. I was about to get in the car to go into, you know, the Sydney. And he came rushing towards me, Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm, got to tell you this. The last meditation of the whole retreat, he was sitting down there and he heard the pop. Pop. He could breathe through his nose. Like a miracle. But only for 1 minute. And then it closed up again. But he was so excited. You know, because this is not imagination. You can actually breathe through his nose. Hadn't been able to do that for weeks. But it closed up again. And I really thought he'd left it too late. So I actually was, you know, a bit disappointed, but, you know, excited that something was happening. But you can imagine what it was like about 3 or 4 months later in Sydney. And this man comes up to me, do you remember me? You know, when a person's really dying of cancer, they look totally different. They're like a shadow, like a sort of person from a refugee camp. Not a refugee camp, but a concentration camp. They look so thin and gaunt and just sick. This guy came up to me and, you know, healthy, middle-aged man, and said, oh, who are you? It's totally unrecognizable. He said, I was that guy. I carried on meditation like you taught me, and the tumor just went, vanished. Now I can breathe, I can live. I said, what are you doing? He said, look, I'm spending all my time now teaching other people what you taught me, because it gave me life, gave me something to do. So I always remember those stories because it's not just about becoming a stream winner, you know, becoming a sort of a non-returner and, you know, becoming smart. It has all these amazing, beautiful side effects, you know, of your health. And not just physical health, your emotional health as well. So many of these stories are used in psychology. I was at a conference in Singapore some years ago, and one of the presenters there, with a big smile on her face, she presented a little video of a psychologist in Sydney who had invented this new technique, a new type of therapy for people dealing with problems in their life. And there on the video, this guy said, well, it's just like a hand. If you hold your hand too close to your eyes, then you can't see anything, only your hand. So my teaching is, said this therapist, just put your hand at the end of the arm where it belongs, and then the problem hasn't got any smaller, but your perspective has changed. You can see other things as well as the hand. Oh, I've been teaching that for years. The fellow stole it from me. And she knew, because, you know, she was an old disciple who'd been coming for years, and she knew that, there you go, all these teachings which you invent, other people take up. But anyway, I don't care, because it's helping people. That's wonderful. That's the most amazing thing. You know, I even went to, Songkran Festival, the Thai New Year. There was another group doing a ceremony, so I went to support them, and that was in Langley Park, just in Perth here. And of course, if you ever go to our ceremonies, we don't invite mayors or councillors or politicians, and because I always think that, you know, why are these people called the VIPs? You're the VIPs. I feel really a bit embarrassed there. You invite these big shots who never go to the temple ever, but when they come, they get front seats, they give a speech, and they haven't got a clue what's going on, they're not members. So I always like to actually to keep our festivals, you know, politician-free. You know, you are the VIPs, because, you know, you support the place all the time, so why do you get these big shots? Anyway, so there was a local member for Perth. She just got voted out, Elena Evangelini or something, the local MP for Perth. So she had to give her speech. And I was sitting in the front row, VIP. A bit of a hypocrite. But there I was, and she was giving her speech and how wonderful the cultures were. And you know, she came out, you know, this politician, business lady, about how to deal with stress. So she had the gall to say, a wise person once told me that stress is about holding a cup for too long and not knowing how to put it down. And I was kidding myself laughing. That's my simile. I was very happy. It went around and around and eventually got to this politician who taught me how to do it. But all those great little teachings actually stop you stressing out in life and make you happier human beings. It's not just about, you know, jhanas, not just about enlightenment. It's about so much more happier, more peaceful, even more successful human beings. You know, teaching you, I say, how to innovate with a simile of this. This is why you get invited to these big conferences with business people. Innovation, research and development, seeing new things, new ways of doing things. So, you know what, I'll use this thing here. What is this? And you look at it, it's not just a gong bonger, it's more than that. So, you know, think of new ways of... Yeah, that's a bit too big, something. I better not mess around too much. There's new ways of doing things, that's innovation. And so people actually innovate in their businesses. And it works. And you make more products, so you know you get more wealthy. And that's important for me, to know that you're comfortable and wealthy. Because the more wealthy you are, the more that donation box in there fills up. If you're really poor, I'm in big trouble. So it's a win-win for everybody. But it actually works. So people are very happy to have new ways of looking at things, new ways of dealing with stuff, so that this meditation actually just, it goes into areas of your life you would never, ever suspect. Of course, you see all these schools these days doing mindfulness. It's just a euphemism for meditation. But we were teaching that here. It must have been about 30 years ago, because I remember going off to the school over in Rolling Stone School. There was this teacher there, year six, Kerry, Australian girl. She would come to our Armadale group, actually, you know, around that area, the South of the River group. She really got into the meditation, and she thought, why not teach the kids in her class? It had amazing effects. She started teaching the kids quiet time, she called it. Not mindfulness, not meditation, because there's a lot of Christians in that area, really quite strict Christians. And if they knew they were being taught something remotely connected to any other religion, they'd have just been looking to crucify somebody. So, well, maybe that's an exaggeration, but you know what I mean. So, there she was, called it quiet time. And she said what happened was 5 minutes in the morning, and then little by little, she would increase it during the day, during the year. So it went about 20 minutes by the end of the school year, grade sixes. And he said the amazing things were happening, that sometimes there was like an argument in the class, you know, boys and girls. Someone got upset at each other and about to really start, you know, really laying into each other, not physically but with words. And then one of the person in the class would say, quiet time please, miss. And so everyone in the class would just sit down quietly, be silent. And that would just totally stop any of this bad feelings. And the whole class became emotionally very supportive of one another. They became more mindful, more aware, which meant that when one kid had a sort of a bad night because maybe the mum and dad were shouting at each other, the other kids would pick it up and look after them. And she said there was parts of that meditation which she never expected to see, side effects which were so pleasing, you know, just like emotional support of one another. She was so pleased with it. It was almost 30 years ago now. So much so that the principal invited me to come to the school to give a talk. And that he, in his office first of all, and said, look, I'm a very devout Christian too, but look, I'll support this woman to the max. And I've been in the business of education for such a long time. I've seen the results. It's not just social results, it's also just the academic achievements are just really huge. It's making a great difference. Well, I always remember that because then I really should take more planning into what I'm doing. They actually asked me to teach, you know, a couple of classes while I was there, grade twos and grade threes. How on earth do you teach Buddhism to actually six-year-olds and seven-year-olds? You can't start talking about dependent origination. It's great because I meditate a lot. You innovate. Just like, you know, you pick this up. What is this? You see things anew. And had all the parents in the back there because, you know, some are a bit concerned what this Buddhist doing. Are they going to convert our kids? And I got them involved as well. So you know what I did? I have this marvelous little way of teaching them about, you know, where our wrong views come from. I asked people, how many of you kids, and there's about 60, 70 there, you know, 2 years, how many of you like rice pudding? I said. And then about a couple of kids put their hand up, they didn't like rice pudding. And the other kids, you know what kids are like, they look around, and a few more kids put their hands up, and the other kids looked around. And in about 2 minutes, 3 minutes, everyone, the whole year twos and year threes, had agreed they didn't like rice pudding. Okay, put your hands down. Now, those of you who've ever eaten rice pudding, put your hands up. And about six kids put their hands up. All the parents were laughing because there, a little exercise, you proved where wrong view comes from, and conditioning and brainwashing. Such a deep teaching just about rice pudding. So when you can meditate, you can innovate like that and have a great deal of fun. So it's also, for if you're a school teacher, if you're in business, research and development, seeing new ways of doing things, meditation helps enormously. But of course, that many of you are also serious Buddhists and you want to get enlightened, why not? That's on offer too. And never ever think that you can't. Many of you won't, but you can in this lifetime. Why not? So people keep asking, is jhana possible? Of course it is. It doesn't mean you will all attain it, but it's there for you if you follow the instructions. You know what happens mostly when people get a new appliance, whether it's a new mobile phone or a tablet or a microwave? How many of you take all the covers off, connect it up, plug it in, turn it on, and then only afterwards you read the instructions? And it goes bang. That's like teaching meditation. Go bang. Ah, jump up, please help. I told you. Read the instructions and follow them first. You wanted something. Bang. But anyhow, we give it a try. Try it this way, try it that way. And eventually get the hang of it. And I told this to one person, and oh, this is so true. You know, sometimes it's like crossing a river. It's a simile the Buddha said, crossing from this side to the other side. But the truth of the matter is that what you have to cross is not very wide at all. You could actually just step over it. So narrow. But most people go up and down, up and down, up and down, instead of turning in a different direction you've ever gone before. Instead of going north or south, you go east. In other words, you go perpendicular to the usual direction you've been traveling in. You actually do something different. So most people are just trying to attain something. When you hear that's not what you should do, you try not to try, which is just going parallel in the opposite direction. It's not doing this wonderful thing called letting go, which is totally different than you've ever done before. That's why I always say there's a button somewhere in your brain, the letting go button. I just spent 9 days trying to point that out to you where it is, but it's so hard to find because it's just so unusual. And it's just so, you can't just let go and get into jhanas that quickly. Not me. Of course you can. And people actually do that. I used to be very interested in people's accounts, you know, people on these retreats when they said they attained jhanas. Not only just asking them what exactly happened, why it happened, but also I used to ask them, what was it you did special this time, which you hadn't done before? You've been sitting down meditating for years. Why did this time you attain this incredible state? And after about 3 or 4 times of asking that question, I never asked it again because they all gave the same answer. They said, I really let go. They really let go. I mean, really. Not half-heartedly. Totally, full-on, let go. And these things happened. And I'll share that with you because if you haven't got this yet, it's because you're still holding on to something. You haven't totally let go. Maybe 90%, 99%. 99.9%, there's always something there you haven't let go of yet. And that stops you, that's a barrier. So after a while, there comes a time, yeah, you just give up. This is enough, I'm just fed up with this, and you let go, and you stop meditating. And then you really are meditating. Then it happens. So it's an amazing little thing which occurs to people. And it could happen any time. So it doesn't matter if you think, oh, this is hopeless, I haven't got anywhere, and how many retreats have I been coming to, and oh. But then just could be before you leave this evening, this afternoon, it could be, you know, when you go home this evening, nothing to do, so might as well meditate. And then one day it happens, you just stop trying, stop doing stuff. And then it's very fast, get into incredible deep states of mind. When you come out afterwards, you've got an idea what letting go is. Beautiful teachings of Buddhism. This is not an effort base. If it was effort base, many of you would give up. And I just haven't got that type of effort. I haven't got that willpower. You know, I'm not really as strong in my body. So I can't put that type of energy or time in. But you don't have to. And you have all these incredible stories in the time of the Buddha. All these people who got enlightened. Amazing. People. They're serial killers. There was crazy lady, Patachara, and she walked into the, while the Buddha was giving a sermon, totally naked. Crazy. Psychotic. And you know what happened? People said, you know, and this happens sometimes, Thai ladies. You know, sometimes, you know, you're in the vihara and people come in just, you know, really low skirts, or was it high skirts or low skirts? The top is low, the bottom is high. You know, with their boobs showing. Say, go away, you know, you'll corrupt the monks. Oh, come on, you know, we've been there and done that. So, you know, we just... But this lady, no clothes on at all. I remember actually just... remember Ajahn Kantipalo years ago? He was one of the first monks who came to Australia. And he was based over in the East Coast. And so they invited him for this festival, you know, spiritual festival, at Nimbin, the hippie capital of Australia. So he didn't know what he was getting into, but they got a tent for him to teach meditation. And these were all young men and young women. And most of them came in totally naked. They'd lost their attachment to clothes. And there this poor man had to sit there, and all these young women there, nothing on at all. If that was in Thailand, well, if someone had taken a photograph of him, his reputation shot in Thailand. But anyways, oh no, keep out. But this the Buddha, all the monks and the other people, oh, get out, you know, so you're not supposed to be naked when you come into a temple. You know, you mustn't wear shoes when you go into the kitchen. But the Buddha said, come in. So he was so kind and open. It's more important the person has a chance to listen to the Dhamma. That's really most important. That is more important than anything else. And one of the monks took his robe off and wrapped it around the woman, and she became this amazing bhikkhuni arahat. When I first read the Teri Gata, the verses of enlightened nuns, it came across story after story after story that this nun had been meditating, getting nowhere, and then this teacher appeared, and in a few days this nun was fully enlightened. And another one, struggling, just like you've been to so many retreats, and just, you know, this was a committed nun, and we didn't know what to do next, nothing worked, never really could meditate properly, and this nun came along, taught her the Dhamma, and she was another arahat with psychic powers, and that was Patachara. Amazing teacher. You know, why? Because, you know, the reason why she was crazy was lost her two children, her parents and her husband all on the same day. And that was just too much. The grief was just broke her mind. She learned how to let go. Had to. No choice. And that's what she was teaching others. You get the right teacher, or rather the right instruction, wham bam, it's fast. You know, all the way. So never give up your hope. It's just find that letting go button. Eventually you press it. And all these incredible things you read about people saying, oh, the time to become enlightened has passed now. No, it has not. There's still people doing this amazing stuff. I already mentioned about that Vietnamese monk, 8 days without moving. Just, you know, shouldn't really do that. But, you know, it just happened by mistake. But it's just showed what's possible in this world. And so that gives you inspiration. That gives you the fact it's possible. Wherever there is the Eightfold Path, there you will find. So stream winners, once returners, non-returners, arahats. It's not who you are, but what you do. Or rather, what you don't do. How you can press that letting go button. And it just happens. And I know that. I've seen it so many times, and it's just so beautiful. The path is alive and well, right here, right now. So that hopefully will give you a lot of inspiration. It's only a matter of time. So, and anyway, as Buddhists, we always get reborn again anyway, so you don't need to rush. You know, in this life, people these days are so much in a rush. They've only got so much time. I'm very busy getting old. What if I don't make it this lifetime? Well, there's another lifetime afterwards. Just like if you haven't made it on this retreat, oh, there's another retreat coming up soon. There's no end to retreats. I tend to finish one and maybe not doing another one here for a couple of months, but overseas, interstate. You're always doing a retreat somewhere. So for me, retreats never end. They just pause. And then you come back again and do the same. So you'll get there sooner or later. And anyway, in the meantime, have a wonderful life. It just gets better and better. Even if you don't get jhanas, you don't get enlightenment, you get wiser, you get kinder. You're a much better person when you go home. Your husband, your wife appreciates you so much. You're so softer, so kinder, so much more sensitive. And the same in work. You know, you can be more friends to the people you work with. So it is win-win all the way. So hopefully you've had a wonderful time here and you've learned so much. And actually, you probably learned much more than you think you have. Some of the stuff which you think you've forgotten, they'll be in there somewhere, just waiting like seeds for the right time to actually to give their fruit. The mango trees are dripping with mangoes, just waiting for you to be still long enough for them to fall in your hand. Just waiting for you. So, that's the final talk. I don't say what to do when you go home because you all know what to do. It happened anyway. So now we do 3 sadhus and then you can have a toilet break. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so toilet break. Please come try and get back by another 10, 15 minutes, and then we'll do the loving kindness just to end this part of the retreat. And the retreat goes on and on and on, in your car, at home, wherever you happen to be. Very good. Excellent.
Very soft.
Yeah. Yo.
Do you need a hot drink?
A hot drink? Yeah, but not now. No. Very good. No, I am fine.